So this is the official welcome to the monthly Zoom meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. Thank you for joining us here today. I'm here as the executive director of the organization, also the founder of the organization. And it's just a real pleasure for me to be here today and every month to help folks who, you know, have a legal issue, maybe you know, there's something that you're wondering about. Why is it this way? Why is it that way? Is there some, you know, is there somebody that I can go to for legal advice? So I say it that way because I want you all to know that Chance Oberstein, we're both attorneys, but we don't give legal advice in these monthly meetings. Okay. In fact, I have a disclaimer to read and I'm going to put my glasses on so I can read it. The Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws is dedicated to protecting the Constitution by restoring the civil rights of registrants and their families. In order to achieve that objective, ACSA will educate and litigate as well as support or oppose legislation. The ACSA website and recordings such as this are provided as a service to registrants, registrants' families, and others for general information only. The information on the website, the ACSA website, and in the recordings are not designed to provide legal or other advice to create an attorney-client relationship. You should not take or refrain from taking action based upon their content. Prior results in cases, case studies, do not guarantee a similar outcome in future representations. ACSA accepts no responsibility for any loss or damages that may result from accessing or reliance upon content on the ACSA website, recordings, and disclaim to the fullest extent permitted by applicable law any and all liability with respect to acts or omissions made by registrants, registrants' families, and others on the basis of content on the ACSA website. So that's certainly a mouthful. But again, I just really want to emphasize for everybody that when we do these monthly meetings, the objective is not for Chance and I to give you individual legal advice, but instead to share legal information. And the distinction I see, I'm going to ask Chance what he thinks about this, the distinction I see between legal advice and legal information is that we will can explain to you what the law says as best we can, but we're not going to talk about your specific circumstances. Having said that, both Chance and I are available for private consultations. We just don't want to do it in a public meeting that's being recorded. It's to protect you as well. Do you want to add something to that, Chance?
No, I think you've covered it pretty well, and I think that's really good advice, and it's a good way to start the meeting off. So thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, folks, we do have a lot of exciting news, things that are happening. I don't know how many of you saw my latest column that I wrote a couple days ago and it's posted on the ACSA website, but I asked this rhetorical question, which is, are judges getting smarter? Right? I mean, it's just a real head scratcher. I can't say it's a trend yet because it's only two decisions by courts, but they're two very positive decisions. And it's something that I think folks on the registry need to know about. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes because we want to talk, Chance and I, about a couple of ongoing issues. These are issues that come up on a constant basis. I know, Chance, you get phone calls about these scams. I get phone calls about the scams, and yet they're still happening, and people really need to know how to deal with it. So you want to start that off, Chance?
Well, yeah. If you get a call and the demand is that you go somewhere and you deposit some money at a kiosk or whatever, and it appears to be like this is law enforcement and they're telling you that there's an issue or a problem with your DNA or anything, you know, you forgot to come to a hearing or whatever, I think you know pretty well what your schedules are and what your obligations are. And I think you understand that when you get a rush call like that from someone who's holding themselves out to be an authority and they want you to go do something that law enforcement would never ask you to do, which is take money somewhere and deposit it or get it to them, I think it's pretty clear that that's a red flag and that's a scam. And so it happens, it morphs, this is done in all different ways. But the main thing to remember is that if you're in compliance, you know, and it's just a monitoring statute, you know, and you don't have anything in the future to do other than to make sure that you keep up with your obligation to register annually or every 30 days or whatever it is, and there's nothing left outside of that, you don't have to really worry about it. You can just hang up the phone. you know, you could just ignore it. But, you know, and if it really is horrendous, you can report it. But know one thing, it's a scam. And, you know, don't get nervous about it. Don't have anxiety about it. Just understand it's a scam.
And very well said there, Chance. I mean, that's the best part about this, folks. If you get a call like Chance described, the easiest and best way to deal with it is just hang up. Now, I understand from people who've had these kind of calls that there's a lot of emotional attachment and there are triggers. Oh, my gosh, you know, we got a car that's ready to, a police car is ready, it's going to come pick you up. And of course, that sounds pretty ominous and et cetera. But the fact is, they're not going to call you. If somebody's going to come and arrest you, they're not going to call you first. They're just going to come and pick you up. And so when you get a call like that, no matter how emotional and how real it seems, and I guess some of them, like they must be like theater actors or something, right? Because some of them have like the sound behind them that sounds like they're in a police station or something like that. Well, okay. I, you know, it's a trigger. It's a way to trigger you and everything. But when they tell you stay on the line, don't hang up, that's, if you haven't already gotten a clue at that point in time, that's the clue. You can always hang up on somebody, right? So if somebody's like, oh my gosh, you have to stay on the phone. And if you don't stay on the phone, we're going to come arrest you. Just hang up on them. Okay. Really, truly, that's all you need to do. So I know some people who like to do some more creative things, blowing whistles in their ears, yelling at them, whatever you want to do, but why waste the effort even to blow a whistle? Just hang up. So anyway, we repeat this, I think, every month, Chance, because every month in between meetings, Chance and I get calls like, oh, my gosh. And somebody said, you know, they want me to pay $10,000. And Chance and I actually know of an individual who did pay a scammer $10,000. And folks, if you pay this money, you will not get it back. OK, there's no, you can't take him to court because who are they? Right. They're like, oh, I'm Sergeant so-and-so. Really? Right. It's a scam. And people who are pretending to be law enforcement officers are not law enforcement officers. So basically, you're going to be out that much money. So enough of that. Let's talk about something else that comes up on a pretty regular basis. That's something called compliance checks, at least what's what they call them here in California. So when you get the knock on the door or they ring the doorbell, please don't shoot them, as somebody did recently, unfortunately, not on a compliance check. But anyway, the fact is that if it's a compliance check and you're on probation or you're on parole, you have to open the door and you have to at least greet them and speak to them. Okay. However, if you're not on parole and you're not on probation, you do not have to talk to them unless they have a warrant for your arrest. And trust me, if they have a warrant, they'll be letting you know. We have a warrant for your arrest. Open the door. Right. And the reason that we say that is that they like to snoop, right? And so unfortunately, even if you open your front door and they can see into your home, they might see something there that looks like drug paraphernalia. I think that's a special one they like to use commonly. Drug paraphernalia. And then the next thing, you know, they are searching your whole home and maybe just have some things there that you'd rather them not see. So the bottom line is that the Fourth Amendment protects you from unreasonable search and seizure. And that includes somebody coming at your home. So if somebody is there indeed on a compliance check, I always advise people walk out the front door and close the front door. Okay. You don't have to even give them a chance to look inside. And even if you lock yourself out, it's going to be worth it. And the cost of a locksmith if it gets to that will be worth it because, again, you don't want somebody searching your house because they think they have probable cause because they saw something that they've considered illegal. Would you like to add to that, Chance?
Yeah. I mean, technically, you can just open up a window and speak out of that. I mean, it's a compliance check. It's all it is confirming that you are at the place you say you live at. That's it. So what you want to do is, you know, be as polite and tactful as possible. And, you know, but you don't have to do much more than just say, yeah, I'm here. and you know, you can or you can't. I mean, it's not like, you know, you're compelled to, and it's not like you're going to be prosecuted if you don't. But, you know, I guess the best way of saying it is, you know, it's nice to be compliant and to have a good relationship with those all around you. But, you know, you can find ways of doing it that, you know, are best suited for yourself. And that's, I think, what we're both trying to get over to you is is be mindful that it could lead to other things and that you need to take, your destiny into your own hands, which means, tailor make it to suit you.
And I think there's just one other thing that I would add to what Chance just said, and that has to do with when they show up and it is indeed a compliance check, basically you give them your name, rank, and serial number, right? That's from old movies in the war, right? But the fact is, all you need to do is identify yourself, and that's it. And yes, I live here. That's it. So if they start asking you about your offense, they start asking you about your personal life, it's really none of their business. And you can even blame it on Chance or I or both of us and say, well, my attorney said not to answer any questions. So if you have any questions, you can get in touch with my attorney. Whatever you need to do, I mean, be polite about it. They have guns after all. And I just believe in general in being polite. But the fact is that you don't have to answer a bunch of questions. So one more thing. This is not something we talk about every month, but I'm happy to report that our lobby day last month in March, on March 21, was actually a huge success. We had the greatest number of people show up. We had 63 people who showed up to lobby our state legislature. And that was totally remarkable because it was rainy, it was cold, it was windy, and we had to walk several blocks because the legislature's meeting, or offices, have moved. So they're no longer in the Capitol. They're a couple blocks away. So we made great progress. We planted a lot of seeds. And I'm going to tell you, despite that, we don't have a sponsor for the legislation that we're promoting, nor do we have an author for the bill. So that's something that we're still working on. I actually have my last lobby day meeting next week, this coming week, with a member, a legislator, and his chief of staff. One of those things, this member has some interest in the topic, and so we've been asked to come in. I was able to look at the list of participants in lobby day and find somebody who was a constituent. So that person is traveling to Sacramento so that in fact he can meet with this assembly member. So it's one of those things. There's a lot of things going on behind the scenes, and we'll talk about it later when we talk about the tiered registry law. But again, thank you everybody so very much for coming to Sacramento for lobby day. It was a great success, and we thank you. Okay, so let's talk about those two cases that I mentioned briefly. And if you weren't on yet, there were two recent decisions here in California, which were just wonderful, positive, and amazing. And now I see our newest board member is on. Hi, Jeff. Good morning. Maybe, why not in about 10 minutes, can I introduce you formally, and then you can talk? Excellent. Okay, so the two decisions I'm talking about, one of them came from Orange County of all places. And the reason I say that is because Orange County is known to be judicially conservative, politically conservative as well, but I'm not talking about the politics. I'm talking about the judges. And so a panel of three judges made a decision that will in fact help a lot of people get off the registry through the petitioning process. And again, we're talking under the tiered registry law. And, after somebody submits a petition, the district attorney has a decision to make about whether or not to object to a petition. And so far, I'd say about 10% of the petitions I've filed have attracted an objection from a DA. Then there's a more extensive hearing that's held, or there actually just in a hearing that's held. And, you bring evidence forward. Well, in our legal briefs, we've always argued that the DA has the burden of proof that somebody poses a current danger. But quite frankly, it was just a legal argument, right? There was no case law. We didn't have case law that said yes. We didn't have case law that said no. That was our argument. And we've been successful in 6 out of 7 cases that I took forward. And that 7th one, by the way, I'm appealing because the judge made a dumb decision that day. But this decision that I'm talking about, and it's called People versus Thai, like Thai food, T-H-A-I. So People versus Thai, this group of judges said, you know what? The DA has a burden of proof. So you can't just wave your hands around DA and say, hey, judge, we think you should require this person to keep registering despite the fact that they've met all the requirements of the tiered registry law. Because, in order to protect, actually, it says significantly enhance community safety. So this panel of judges said, not good enough. You have to actually bring us evidence that would in fact occur. And that shifting of the burden was fabulous. And I just see us attorneys, Chance and Jeff and other criminal, you know, defense attorneys working on these petition cases. I just see us running forward with this decision. I know it's made me really happy. And I actually have a case coming right up in Orange County of all places. And I feel a lot more comfortable that that judge was going to grant the petition. But what do you think about that case, Chance?
Well, you know, that's been my standard argument since we've been doing these petitions. And, so far so good. I mean, I think that, you know, it takes a little time to educate judges. It's a new body of law. And, you know, this is, the beginning of, carving out just exactly how that law is going to work. So this is a very positive thing. I like that. And I hope to progress further. And I hope to get to, you know, it would just be so wonderful to get to just a risk-based analysis, period. And I know there's a lot of other factors that prosecutors like to bring in, but I think this is a good move in that direction. Actually, I think it's a wonderful move in that direction. So I'm very pleased with that.
Well, great. Jeff, I think this is a great segue into introducing you. And so, folks, Jeff Stein is the newest member of the Axel Board of Directors. We're so pleased that he's joining us as a board member. And I've known Jeff for 10 plus years, just as a professional colleague. But Jeff knows one of our other board members for over 40 years, and that's Alex Landon. So, Jeff, I know you have you're a criminal defense attorney. You have a long practice there in San Luis Obispo County, and also that you've been active filing petitions. Is that correct?
Yes, I've actually had petitions here and in other counties around the state. I've been active as a legislative committee member and then chair for California Attorneys for Criminal Justice on three separate occasions, and have been working in this area since I was a baby public defender in the 1970s. I think it's always the case that the law grows. Sometimes it grows worse. In this case, it grows much better when SB 384 was evolving. The legislative content was tremendously favorable in the way the law got structured. So People versus Tye really is the arguments that all the advocates made in favor of a reform, which was to say there's no danger. It's pretty much the argument that the Sex Offender Management Board put out in their 2014 community safety report, and the legislature got courage and picked it up. And this court did exactly the right thing in articulating that public policy theory. So it's a great tool. The very first time I had to present it to a DA, they said, well, maybe we'll withdraw our opposition and just agree to the petition. So
and that's a good sign.
It's positive movement for sure.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
Well, thank you, Jeff. We're thrilled to have you. And maybe folks who are not attorneys don't know so much about the California Attorneys for Criminal Justice, but I will tell you that they're a fabulous organization. They've been in existence, I think, for 50 years now. And, you know, they have a lot of resources, quite frankly, that we don't have yet. So the fact that Jeff, who's former president of the CACJ Board of Directors, as well as Alex Landon, who has been on our board for at least 5 years and such, it's great to have such power and experience join the board. Thank you, Jeff. You're okay. Certainly welcome.
Glad to help.
So, all right. So there was one other decision that came out this during the last 30 days, and it has to do with people who are on parole. So registrants who are still on parole. And I think it's especially important because the parole periods seem to keep getting longer. Probation periods are getting shorter and some parole periods are getting much longer. So I've talked to people who have parole periods of 20 years. That's a really long time to be on parole. And especially if you follow what was said in this case. So it was in San Mateo County. And basically, during a hearing, the CDCR representatives, two of them, said, oh, well, it's CDCR policy that any registrant on parole has to continue treatment throughout the period of their parole. And, you know, that was my guess as to what they were doing. But the fact that they were more than willing to make this statement, you know, testifying in court, then in fact that that's their policy. And you know what? That's not consistent with the law. Okay. And also there's a part of the law that says that a judge has the right, has the discretion really, to stop treatment after only 1 year. And these are people on parole. The specific individual in the case that I had, he completed a 3-year treatment program. He got a certificate saying basically you completed the program. And then only 2 months later, he was contacted by a different treatment provider telling him he was going to have to start the program, their program, all over again. And this is something that really was, upsetting to the judge. And so she was very courageous that day. And she said, no, not on my watch. I'm not going to do this. I have the discretion to end treatment, and I'm basically exercising that discretion. I think that there are a lot of other people out there here in California anyway, who are on parole and being told that they have to repeat treatment. And one of our board members on the foundation side, in fact, is a treatment provider, and she's been frustrated for many years trying to end treatment for individuals only to be told, nope, they have to keep undergoing treatment. Now it's like the cat's out of the bag. And again, CDCR testified that they always require every single person who's on the registry and on parole to continue treatment throughout that period of time. And, you know, why is that a bad thing? One, it costs money. Two, it costs time. And so the individual who was my client, he was sometimes told, given less than 24 hours notice, that he had to come in for a counseling session. And he's like, excuse me, I have a full-time job. And don't we all want people on the registry to have full-time jobs and be productive members of society? Of course we do. So how can somebody do that if they're given less than 24 hours notice and they have to turn around and tell their boss, oh gosh, gee whiz, I'm not going to be here tomorrow. So anyway, the judge saw through that. And again, I think that this is something that led me to ask the question, are judges in California getting smarter? I hope that they are. I hope this is a trend and not just, a couple of bubbles. I don't know, Chance or Jeff, do you want to add anything to that? Either the importance of the issue.
I'll defer to Jeff on this for a minute. Go ahead, Jeff. You're new.
Just in general, what I find is that probation has the same general philosophic position that parole has. They want to keep people in treatment the full time that they're on probation. And most of the judges defer to probation. So it's great to have some alternative view. But if it's up to individual judge discretion, it's probably going to remain difficult.
And that's the way I see it, too. It's been my experience the same. But this is good. This is good. You know, there's something to, chipping away at this mountain at the toe, because if you get enough room at the toe, the top starts to lean forward and pretty soon the whole thing crumbles. So it's good news anyway around.
And I'm seeing something in the comments section reminding us all that many times the registrant has to pay for treatment, right? You're paying for the sessions that you go to. You're paying for polygraphs, which in fact is considered part of this containment model. So getting somebody off or, to end the treatment is a huge step forward. And by the way, Axtel is quite interested in pursuing other cases. There's something we put on the website. We're asking people who are in this situation, and again, that you've completed at least one treatment program and told that you have to basically complete another treatment program. So if you're in that situation, please contact me, Chance, I guess Jeff now, or you can just go onto the Axtel website. And there's an email address there that you can look at. So I think it's an important issue. The petitioning issue, the People versus Thai cases, will apply to even more people. But I'm pretty sure there are like 7,000 people, more than 7,000 people on parole here in California, according to the California Department of Justice. Okay, we've got a hand up. So I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself. The last four digits of your phone number are 840. No name, but the phone number 840. Got your hand up, ma'am or sir? And I'm asking you to unmute yourself. Give me another minute or two here. Okay. I do see in the chat room here, somebody talked about, you said, before I moved to California, I was required to pay for weekly treatment and polygraph tests in the state of Washington. I'm sure that got expensive. Well, oh, here we go. Unmuted. No? Please, 840 rather. Do you have a question or a comment?
Yes, I do. You can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm currently going to these classes through Sharper Future in California.
Okay.
And I've been on parole going on 5 years. Right here at this group that I go to, they don't hand out certificates. The problem here is that they keep switching out facilitators.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of difficult to finish the program, and it just continues over and over and over. Is that a factor in this case that you're talking about, or?
Absolutely. Contact me offline if you would, or do you have my email address?
Yes, I do.
Okay, contact me by email, please. You're exactly the type of person we want to talk to. And again, that is what happened to this gentleman who was my client in the case. So in other words, he completed a program using one provider, the one that he was told to by CDCR, only, and then CDCR entered into a contract with a different treatment provider. And even though he got his, quote, certificate from the first provider, he was contacted 2 months later by this new provider saying, oh no, you have to start all over again. So that's nonsense. By the way, what the law says you have to complete 1 year of treatment. 1 year. Not three, not five, and certainly not 20. It says 1 year. And after that first year, then it's discretionary. Okay, we've got another person with the hand up. Thank you, 840. As I said, please contact me privately. JD, you've got your hand up.
Yes, hi. I also was in Sharper Future, and I didn't have a different, like, it was the same provider the whole time. But the person that was the administrator of it, they would finish the program in, like, 14 months and then start from scratch again. So he said, we don't give out any certificates. And people basically had to repeat listening to the same exact 14 months worth of verbiage over and over again. And I'm wondering whether that also, if having to be on there for 3 years, hearing the same stuff, if that counts. And in my case, I was told by the parole board for early discharge that because I was not put onto maintenance, that I was not able to discharge. And that kept me out of my county where my father lived and died because I couldn't get home to take care of him. And it was just a rather frustrating thing because I went to every session and I had passed every polygraph, and I think I qualified for early discharge, but they used the Sharper Future never lets you out as the reason to keep me from discharging.
You know what? You brought up a really good issue there, JD. And so I'd like to repeat it. And what he just said is basically he was not able to get off of parole because he hadn't completed treatment. I mean, think about this, right? This is circular logic. Oh, you didn't complete treatment, so you can't get off parole. You're not off of parole, therefore you have to continue treatment. So on and on and on. You're just, again, the type of person that I would like to hear from. And please contact me. I've just put my phone number, Chance's phone number, Jeff Stein's phone number in the chat room. So please contact one of us about this issue, and let's take it forward. I really think that we can make some progress in the courts.
Okay. Janice, I filled out that little email that was on the website. Does that get to you?
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
Well, not yet. It's not actually going to me. It's going to my assistant, and he had the day off on Friday. So we'll talk about it on Monday. But thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely. We appreciate you too. Thanks. Okay. So let's talk about SORNA regulations, right? The continuing saga of SORNA regulations. So I assume that there's some people online today that don't know what I'm talking about when I make reference to SORNA regulations. So here's the background, and then Chance, I'll ask you to weigh in if you would. So the federal government drafted and proposed regulations to the SORNA, the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. Okay, they did that, oh my gosh, more than 2 years ago now. When they issued these proposed regulations, we were alarmed at what they said and what they didn't say. And the biggest problem I had then and I still have is the vagueness. What do you mean? And in fact, the biggest issue is who did these regulations even apply to? So there's also there were proposed regulations. We and over 700 people and organizations basically submitted comments about those proposed regulations, and they basically rubber stamped them and just turned the proposed regulations into final regulations. So fortunately, there's an organization out there that has a lot more resources than Axol currently, and they're called the Pacific Legal Foundation. So they contacted us and said, hey, we're really upset about these regulations. And trust me, it was music to our ears that somebody else cared, especially an organization as large as Pacific Legal Foundation. So what they care about mostly is about the separation of powers. I can't say that they really care about registrants and registrants' families per se, but they care a lot about the separation of powers. By the way, when I talk about the resources this organization has, they have more than 40 attorneys, 40. And in addition to that, they've taken 17 cases to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've won 14 of them. That's a great track record. So I'm very confident that they're going to do that. They are doing and will continue to do a fabulous job on behalf of the registrants. So a loss. Well, before I go on talking about the status of the lawsuit, Chance, maybe you can talk about some other problems that you see in those regulations.
Well, you know, again, as Janice says, they're very vague. And she asked the question, who do they apply to? Well, they apply to registrants, even California registrants. Actually, the injunction is limited to those who have gotten relief through the California instruments of relief, like a, you know, if they've been removed from the registry through a COR or they've been removed through the tiered system, it doesn't apply to them now temporarily until this whole issue is decided, but it applies to everyone else who's on the registry, whether they're in California or elsewhere. And there are some very specific things on there that are required. And I would recommend that you try to read and understand them, the best you can. You got me. I mean, I look at it and it's very hard to grapple with. As a matter of fact, even the prosecutor doesn't even know how they work or how they're applied or what they do. To be honest with you, when you listen to her, she doesn't know. And this is what's caused the confusion, has caused the judge in our case to do what he did. I know they have a pending motion to dismiss. I don't see that. I think this thing is going to go forward. It certainly is a very strong separation of powers issue, delegation of powers. And so, you know, we're kind of at a standstill here. I don't know, and I haven't heard of any prosecutions based on this rule so far. And if anybody else has any information about that, that would be helpful, but I see none at this point. And so we're kind of in limbo until these issues get worked out.
Thank you, Chance. Jeff, do you want to weigh in at all on this?
So I'd say my starting point with, SORNA was, coming to appreciate that there was risks. A client who I have terminated successfully in state proceedings is now plaintiff John Doe number 3 in the lawsuit because the lawsuit was proceeding and it needed someone who was at risk and solve the problem that the courts call mootness. And this client was one who fit perfectly, and Pacific Legal took him as one of their plaintiffs. So what's the difficulty with SORNA is for me as a reasonably informed person, I read that set of regulations extensively and couldn't figure out how to keep the client from being vulnerable to being prosecuted. The nature of the law is that everybody who was convicted is in the federal view a registrant, whether they're still required to be registered under California law or not, which seems crazy, but nonetheless, after direct contact with the federal authorities that run this program, they were absolutely unconcerned that a California termination meant anything of consequence to them. And as a result, we felt the need to participate. The client was a perfectly suited client to help the lawsuit out. And as Janice said, the Pacific Legal Foundation attorneys have their own purposes which drive their action, but it serves our purposes. So we have a kind of a marriage of convenience. There's a line from Shakespeare, from The Tempest, which is that misery acquaints a man with strange bedfellows. And we are in that way partnered, but not necessarily fully embracing Pacific Legal's philosophic goals, but they're a tremendously helpful and talented tool to accomplish the legal change that we want to see. So everybody in California who's been terminated under either certificates of rehabilitation or under the tier system is now exempt from being prosecuted while the lawsuit is proceeding. I think Chance is exactly right that the current efforts won't affect the existing stay that's imposed against the federal government from proceeding. And it's going to be working its way through the court, probably a multi-year project to get to a conclusion.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. And I concur completely with what you just said. So folks, you know, it's like, well, okay, you know, why should anybody care about SORNA and these new regulations? It's because if you were to be convicted of violating the SORNA regulations, if you could end up in federal prison for 10 years, up to 10 years, right? And so we're here, Jeff, Chance, and I are here to try to help you avoid that from happening. And so we're sharing with you legal information. And again, we're not doing a case-by-case basis. We're not giving anybody specific legal advice. But we want you to know that there's a problem out there. And it's kind of strange. I almost see this as like the battle between states and the federal government with regard to marijuana. So, okay, California and many other states, marijuana is legal, a certain amount of it anyway, but the federal government still says it's illegal, right? And so there's these, you know, this tension and this fight that's gone on for a really long time. I think it's going to go on for a lot longer as well. And I think we're in a similar situation here because folks, the federal government has wanted all the states to comply with SORNA for, I think, the last 15 plus years. And most of the states are ignoring that federal law and saying, no, thank you. We understand you want us to do it, but we're not going to do it. And the federal government has dangled a carrot. It has to come in the form of grant funding. Okay, for states that are complying with SORNA, we're going to let you apply for these grants. But states like California and 37 other states, I believe at this point in time, have said thanks, but no thanks. Keep your money. And they realize, the states have realized that it would cost more money to enforce the SORNA regulations than they could possibly get in a grant program. And here's one example. This is just the clearest example that I can think of in these SORNA regulations. Some of the requirements are vague, but some of them are crystal clear. And so here's one that says, if you're on a tier three, you're a tier three offender according to SORNA, not your state law. If you're a tier three offender, you're going to have to register 4 times a year. What? So what's going to happen in California when somebody who by state law is only required to register once a year goes into the registration office, you know, 3 months later and says, okay, I'm here to register again. And the registration office says, get out of here. We don't register people more than once a year. We're not going to register you. Well, gosh gee whiz, you know, and this is not just specific to California, folks. Other states are similarly situated where somebody registers maybe twice a year, maybe once a year. And here under the SORNA regulations, it's telling you have to register 4 times a year. Technically, if you don't do that, it's a violation of federal law. But the question is, and Chance, I think you know, noted, and I would agree, I don't know of anybody, thank God, who's been prosecuted under these regulations yet. So I think the federal government is agreeing that they want to find out what, in fact, these regulations really mean. I'm sorry, folks, it's that is so confusing, but it is. And so for Chance and Jeff and I to try to give you legal information, we can't give you a crystal clear picture. By the way, Jeff mentioned a preliminary, a motion to dismiss the case. I think maybe you mentioned it as well, Chance. There's actually a hearing coming up. It's scheduled for June 5th. Please stay tuned. I say that because this particular court has scheduled so many hearings, and I think in one instance at the end they said, oh, well, we don't need a hearing after all. We'll just make a decision based on the written record. Federal district court judges have that option, folks. Actually, so does state court judges. So, but the feds seem to exercise it more often than the state fed judges. But anyway, there's a hearing on a motion to dismiss filed by the government. I agree with Jeff. I don't think it's going to be successful. But you know what? It could be really interesting to watch and observe the oral argument. You can do it. You can participate online. I don't know. There's a theory out there that one reason the judge kept changing the date for the hearing in the past is he really didn't want a whole bunch of people required to register in his courtroom. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, whoever, you can still watch it online. In fact, I mean, I don't know how many flights I had reservations. I had hotel reservations that I kept canceling because of that. So anyway, it is what it is. And the fact is the parties have already said, so both the government and Pacific Legal Foundation has already said we don't need oral argument, right, on this motion to dismiss. And the judge said, well, I don't care what you said. I'm scheduling this hearing, but I reserve the right to cancel it. The judge is reserving the right to cancel it. So that's how concise the law can be sometimes. It I don't know about you, Chance and Jeff. Sometimes I feel like I'm shooting at a moving target and they're harder to hit. But it is what it is. And again, there's a hearing on June 5th. If anybody who's on the meeting right now, if you have a question about the SORNA litigation or the SORNA regulations, this would be a good time to put your hand up. Do you want to make a comment about it? We will do, Chance, Jeff, and I will do our best to share information with you about that. This is a good time to put your hand up. I don't see too many people's faces, which is fine, but so I'm going to ask you instead, can you use the reactions button down at the bottom of your screen, in fact, and do it that way. Okay. I don't see any. Oh, there we go. I don't see any hands up. So why don't we just go ahead and move on? Why don't we talk about privately owned websites? It's not a topic that we discussed before as one of these monthly meetings, but a couple of people have brought it up to me in the last 30 days since our last meeting. And so I did want to go ahead and tee up the topic. It's becoming especially important to people in California who are, you know, successful in petitioning for removal from the registry. And so their names are removed from their state website. But guess what? They're still on privately owned websites. And the biggest problem so far that has been identified is a website called HomeFacts. So HOME and then Facts, FACTS, HomeFacts. And so one of my clients has been very busy and devoting some significant resources to trying to communicate with HomeFacts, sending them a copy of his court order saying he's no longer required to register, et cetera. And he's totally frustrated in trying to get himself off that website. He did have success in some other websites. The other websites is like, okay, you know, if you're no longer required to register, send us information and we'll take you off. But HomeFacts and maybe one other one, people are still being listed there. So we're trying to figure out who HomeFacts really is. Isn't that that was almost a bizarre statement to make. Who is HomeFacts? I mean, HomeFacts is a website. It's available globally, right? But who are the people really behind it? And we don't know yet. But it's kind of a heads up for people who have in fact been removed from the state registry and their state Megan's Law website. You might still be on a privately owned website. So I guess I'm putting it out there. Hans, if you want to comment on this, Jeff, if you want to, and if anybody here is having an issue like that, that they're concerned about.
It doesn't surprise me, but I don't have any specific information about it. The tendency for the internet is to make things exist and never go away.
Right. Yeah. How about you, Chance?
Well, I do believe in the right to be forgotten. Unfortunately, it's not an American ideal. It's a European one. But I wish it were applied here. I hope in the future that we're going to be discussing something like that as part and parcel with the remedy of being removed from the registry. I don't think people should be held to that for, you know, a lifetime when we deem them, you know, to be those types of folks we trust and don't need to monitor anymore. So I would hope that the state would follow suit in a civil way.
Yeah, thank you. And so I will just tell you what it says. So this is from Home Facts. And this is one of my clients who's no longer required to register in California, who's tried to get off this Home Facts website. It's got his name, and then it says dash registered sex offender. And I think that the word registered there is significant. So it doesn't say that he's a former or anything else. It says registered sex offender. And so it's got some information about him. I'm putting my glasses on because I want to read this fine print. Because listen to this. I'm reading this, folks. This is what it really says. No representation is made that this individual is currently on the state's offenders registry. It doesn't even say sex offender. Then it says all names presented here were gathered at a past date. Some persons listed might no longer be registered offenders, and others might have been added. You know, I'm like, what? Some addresses or other data might no longer be current. So, I mean, it just goes on and on. So accordingly, you should confirm the accuracy and completeness of all posted information before making any decision related to any data presented on this site. I don't know about you all, but I find that very troubling language. So they're going to put in really big, bold letters at the top of this page, this website page, that you are a registered sex offender. And then in very tiny print at the bottom, right, that fine print that we lawyers always talk about, and fine print it says, well, this information may or may not be true. I don't know that that takes them off the hook, you know? And the question is this defamation? I don't know, especially for people who are no longer required to register. And so maybe if in fact we choose to litigate this issue, the question we might define is, what is the definition of registered sex offender, right? I mean, if you're going to use the term registered, that word registered in the term, doesn't that mean somebody's currently registered? I don't know. Chance?
Well, it's of course, seems to me to be a disclaimer probably generated by an attorney who is looking after the Home Facts page or whatever, but you know, the truth of the matter is defamation cases are very, very difficult, very, very difficult to establish, but sometimes necessary in order to get down to what's what, you know. But if you're going to start to parse words and things like that, you know, maybe, oh, fine, we'll drop registered. We'll just go with sex offender because that is a label that we can use, you know, all time and all ways. Facebook did that one time. And I just think that it's just a game of thrones when it comes to this issue. It's one thing after another. And I don't think in America you're ever going to stop it because, you know, it just seems to be such the way of our current societal thinking and paradigm about this issue. And so, you know, you can try to fight City Hall, but I'm just not sure that we're going to be successful there. We may be able to define some terms and we may be able to educate some folks, but, you know, it's going to take a lot of time to shift to a much, what I would say, brighter view, an enlightened view of this issue. It's just not happening right now.
Yeah. And why would we care about this issue? Well, it can affect employment decisions. It can affect housing situations, and it can affect your social life as well. When somebody Googles your name these days and this comes up and somebody goes, oh my God, this person's a registered sex offender. Well, I mean, I'm thinking 10 years from now and somebody's been off the registry for 10 years, you know, the a state court judge has basically declared you to be rehabilitated, right? And the legislature is like, oh, this is not a person that we need to continue to monitor. Gosh, gee whiz, there's got to be something that we could and should do about this. I'm seeing in the chat room, a gentleman said that he is listed on Norton's Reputation Defender and that they're charging $2,500 to remove him from that website. I'm really interested in that situation. I will be looking into it. So thank you for sharing that, John B. I did file a lawsuit, by the way, gosh, more than 5 years ago against a series of privately owned websites. They were called Offendex, and then they had other related names. It was a case that was really difficult, and I had several plaintiffs. My only plaintiff who was successful, and by the way, I filed in federal district court in California. It got transferred to Arizona, unfortunately, because the defendant lived there, supposedly. He really lived in Mexico, but oh well. The fact is, and that's where his servers were as well. Somebody's got an address for Humpbacks. Thank you. But the thing is about the Offendex people, they too were charging people money to get removed from the website. And it was only $499, not $2,500. You know, folks, it's just wrong, right? It's just wrong. And even though we were only partially successful in the Offendex case, I'm optimistic that we can maybe reach a different conclusion, especially since somebody has a Humpbacks date right here. I'm sorry, address that's in Irvine, California. If I could file this lawsuit really in California, that would be a lot. I think we'd get a better result. And I don't know about this other website about Norton's Reputation Defender, but I'm hoping they're in California as well. I'm actually taking a picture of my cell phone of this information from the chat room because it's going to disappear. Anyway, it boggles my mind where you go to all the trouble and expense to get off the sex offender registry in your state only to have these private websites still up. And the fact is that your name, you know, that somebody Googles your name and somebody uses some, you know, old information to reach an adverse conclusion. So I don't see any hands up on this issue, but before we go on, let me give you one more chance. If you have a question, if you have an experience with one of these websites, this is a good time to put your hand up. Share with us what experience you've had. If you, in fact, you've had some positive experience in getting yourself off one of these websites, or, you know, if you've been trying and been unsuccessful so far. And I'm looking right now at some comments here in the chat room too. So Mike, you ask, is a defamation lawsuit possible? I think that it is. Defamation lawsuits are difficult, as we just found out. A certain news network was sued for defamation. It got settled, but I'd say that was a successful end to that lawsuit. And so we would not be pursuing money to get this taken down. We just want them to stop doing it. And I know with the Offendex case, one of the reasons that they were successful partially was in fact that the website said that it was an archive. Okay. Not that it was actively, you know, people were actively registered, but it was an archive, and that saved their bacon in that case. I still think the decision ultimately was wrong, but it is what it is. And what we're up against, too, just to remind you all, is the First Amendment. So the First Amendment says you have the right to share information that's truthful, okay, truthful, not lies, but truthful. And so a lot of people get protected that way. And that's why if somebody says on their website this is an archive, it's really hard to fight. But I don't see on Humpbacks that it says it's an archive. They just have this, you know, this disclaimer here, which I don't think is worth the paper that's not printed on. But that's just my opinion. Okay, so again, don't see any hands up here about SORNA or about the privately owned websites. So let's go ahead and talk about travel. And I'm going to save the issue of tiered registry law to the end, because again, we have some people who are out of state who joined us today and maybe don't care so much about what's happening in the tiered registry law in California. But I think that you would care about domestic and international travel. Chance, you are our international travel expert. So how about if you start that?
Well, I'll try to be. International travel. You've got to be mindful of IML, which is International Megan's Law. And unfortunately, even though we're not a SORNA state, I think it's a good idea to abide by those rules, especially in lieu of the new SORNA rule. So if you're planning on doing international travel, the possibility that you may be accepted or not once you get there, and you know how you do it, which is giving 21 days notice before you go, 21 days or more, depending on whether or not you're required to do so. If your conviction is a conviction that involves a minor and you're a current registrant, you know, you're gonna have a demarcation on your passport if you don't have one already, or one in the future. I can't say that's going to be a for sure thing because the federal government, sometimes the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. So, you know, perhaps someone falls through the cracks or whatever, but that is the general idea. IML is geared towards that, you know, a conviction that involves a minor and for a person who's a registrant. Although I will say that people who've been removed from the registry, according to the government, are still subject to those rules, but don't have to do the same thing. They're subject to notice requirements if a pattern's established that they're traveling to countries where there's sex trafficking. That is from the government's mouth to our ears. But in terms of what we've got here, the most important thing to understand is, one, comply, I think, with that SORNA requirement so that you don't become the first test case, which is what I'm saying, is do the 21 days notice. And two, make sure that the point of destination is the type of place that's going to be accepting rather than rejecting. And most places on this planet are becoming more and more adverse. There are some countries that are not. They're called the Schengen countries. And if you've never looked at those, you might want to Google those and take a look and see what those encompass. But actually, I think they're the best countries in Europe and they're a marvelous place to go. But places like Mexico and most places in Asia and things, they're pretty much off limits. And those are nice destinations too, but can't beat the Schengen nations. And I'll let Janice fill you in on that because one of those nations is one of her favorite places.
Italy, you're right. So I'm of Italian descent and I've been Italy several times and I plan to go several more times. Where can you get better wine and food after all? So anyway, the other major Schengen nations are Spain, France, and Germany. Also nice places to visit. And then there's 22 smaller countries. So that information is available on the AXA website. Under travel, it's up above, it's on the homepage of the website, and there's a button that you can click on, a link you can click on that says international travel. And so we have the list of Schengen nations right there. And folks, you can go to those countries and they will allow you to enter. And so what Chance and I are trying to protect you from, if it's possible, is going to a country where you're going to spend a lot of time and money getting to that country only to be turned away. And I mean, they're not even going to let you out of the airport. It's not that you're going to get to go visit your friends and relatives and then go back. No, they will not even let you out of the airport. And when you're in the airport, they won't let you talk to those people. So please spare yourself from the trouble and expense of going to a country that's going to turn you away. There's a website out there. It's a Registrant Travel Action Group, or RTTAG, where they have information listed there about people's experiences in international travel. So it's not run by a lawyer. It's not, you know, it's not legal advice at all. It's just a reflection of people's experiences. Now, sometimes people have different experiences in the same location, but most of the time it's pretty consistent. And, you know, one very sad example that I can think of is I had a client whose wife is Japanese. She's a Japanese citizen. And so when they went there together, and folks, if you're not speaking, could you please mute yourself? We're getting some background interference. So anyway, they were actually going to Japan to go buy a house, a second residence. They live here in California, and they were going to buy a second residence. And lo and behold, they would not let him out of the airport. And so guess what? They didn't buy the second residence, because if he's not going to be able to live there, why would you buy a home? Again, we're just trying to give you these warnings. I know another gentleman who has a small company, a small business, and their company got a contract with a very prominent South Korean company, and they had this big meeting that they're all going to come together and, break bread or drink sake or whatever they did, we're going to do. And so he bought his ticket, and he was not even allowed on the airplane in that particular case. And finally, the airline explained it to him. Well, we're not going to let you on the airplane because we know that they're not going to allow you to enter the country. So Chance is absolutely accurate when he says Asia is off limits right now. Sorry about that, but it's just what it is. And again, we're trying to save you money, time, and possibly embarrassment too when you get to a foreign country and they won't let you out of the airport. Okay, so Rafael, you got your hand up. I think you have a question or comment here about international travel.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and thanks a lot for the work that you work through. We're talking about landing in those countries, but what happens when you are on a train and you take a train from Germany going to Paris? Has anybody experienced what happens then? Do they stop you at the train terminal? Do they allow you to go in?
Would you like to answer that, Chance?
I really couldn't make out that question. It's kind of muffled. I don't know if you heard that.
Okay, Rafael, I don't know. Can you speak more directly into the phone? I don't know if you're on speaker or whatever, but I think I understand what you said, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I disconnected my headphones to see if this worked. Can you hear me okay?
Better, yes.
Hello, can you hear me okay now?
Yes, what's your question?
Oh, the question was, has anybody experienced what happens when you are on a train, say going from Germany to France? Have been difficulties getting into France that way, or were you still exposed to the rejection?
Did you hear that okay, Jim?
I didn't really hear that well, but let me see if I think what you're trying to say is if you sneak into the country some other way, are you going to get rejected? And the answer is, if you sneak into the country, you're in the country. If you're stopped at any borderline, which is what most countries are doing right now, even in Schengen countries, you're going to be stopped and your passport's going to be looked at and inspected. And you might even have to answer a question or two. And there are new visa requirements that you may need to review before you attempt to do that. And there are things that are changing because it's always dynamic. But as far as going to a country that, you're outright not going to be admitted into. And, if you try to go by train and someone's walking along the aisles and inspecting IDs, or you get to a border checkpoint and they check it, at some point, you're either going to be rejected or taken into what I would call custody, but obviously detained. And so you do it at your own risk, but I think the parameters here are pretty clear. Some countries are admitting, some aren't, and you know which ones they are, and the rest, if you know your way around, is if you know your way around, and it's all kind of hit and miss.
All right, thank you, Chance. And Rafael, I think you asked about two different Schengen nations. I believe that you can travel freely between all the Schengen nations without a problem. The problems arise if you try to go to Asia. Problem arises if you try to go to the United Kingdom, any of the UK countries, England, Ireland, et cetera, Scotland. You're not going to be able to enter. So again, why not spare yourself the trouble and the expense of something like that? Chance, I remember a long time ago, you educated me on something which has to do with the fact is that there are no civil rights in an airport, right? It's like it's not even a country. You're in a no man's land, quite literally. And so once you get there, you know what? they're not going to necessarily treat you properly. I've heard people, you know, been detained for hours without food, without water, without access to a cell phone. They're just put in, you know, no man's land, literally. And some people that have had, you know, large groups who are waiting for them, family, friends, et cetera, and you can't even communicate with them. So folks, we're again, Chance and I are trying to give you some, really identify where some landmines are. You can make your own decisions. Certainly, maybe, you know, something happens, a miracle happens, and you get in. But so many times people do not get in, and it's very sad. Jeff, I didn't call on you with this issue. I don't know if the overseas travel is an issue that you get involved with very often.
It's of importance, but it's been inscrutable trying to clarify what's permissible and what's going to be prohibited. Excuse me. So I feel like a consumer here as opposed to an advisor.
Okay.
Good information.
Chance and I've been talking about for years. And some of it just is, you know, individual experiences. Every once in a while, somebody is admitted into a country and we're surprised. But we're trying to tell you what the general rules are. And again, Asia, there is one exception in Asia, and that's Hong Kong. Of course, Hong Kong seems to have all kinds of political issues. But if you want to go visit Hong Kong, I think you can go visit Hong Kong. And then, of course, we're not giving you legal advice, but we can share stories about people who go to some place like a Schengen nation. And once they're there, not before, but once they're there, they might purchase a ticket somewhere else where they might not be allowed or on a general basis. So, again, people are being creative. You just need to know. It's kind of consumer beware, right? Or buyer beware. And again, we're trying to save you time and money traveling someplace far, far away, only to be turned away once you get there and be totally frustrated and not even being able to communicate with the people that you're planning to visit. So that's what happens. Chris has a question or a comment. Chris, I'm asking you to unmute yourself, please.
Yes, hi. Yes, I'm wondering if we know what exactly is said by the marshals in their alert to the countries we're traveling to. Is it a general thing they say regarding every registrant, or do they look at the conviction and choose what they say based on their, I guess, what they've done in the past?
I have seen a few. I haven't seen as many notices as I'd like to see them, because I'd like to see every one of them. But generally what happens is that the country to which you're traveling is notified that you have been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Now, why I have so many problems with that statement is like, well, that's a pretty benign statement, right? You were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. Well, it doesn't have anything to do. There's no definition of what minor is, right? So the federal government, the U.S. government, defines minor is under age 18, okay? The federal government says the age of consent is 18. So if you're having any sexual contact with somebody under the age of 18, guess what? You're now, you know, have a sex offense involving a minor. Well, how about the country to which you are traveling? What is their age of consent? I understand age of consent in some countries is 12, right? But it doesn't say on that statement that our government makes that this involved a 17-year-old, right? And they're like, what? What's wrong with having sexual contact with a 17-year-old, right? You know, I mean, come on. This is just so stupid. And then think about it, too. They said you've been convicted, but it doesn't say when you were convicted, right? And I always think of Frank Lindsay, who now was convicted more than 45 years ago, that Frank Lindsay was convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. But it doesn't say 45 years ago. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense. So the person who's reading this piece of paper in the other country is basically defining these terms by their own law and not by reality. So I don't think that the records actually reflect many times what the person's conviction was. Again, you know, and was this person a stranger? Was it, you know, or a family member? I mean, all these things that should make a difference. And this information is not being sent to the country to which you're traveling. And because of that, I think it causes certainly more problems than it needs to. And then on top of that, we can put this, you know, whole idea about the fact that U.S. government is sending lots of money to many of these countries, including Mexico and Canada, but certainly Mexico. And so, you know, Mexico's like, oh, the U.S. wants us to do this. They're sending us this notice. It must be important. Therefore, we're not going to let this person enter. I don't think it's anything more than that. So anyway, to answer your question, I think the notice says this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. So, Mark, you got your hand up?
I'm sorry. Are we able to obtain a copy of what is said?
Most of the time, not. Most of the time, people don't even get the notices.
Yeah, you're not going to get a copy of anything unless you get deported, and it's wrapped up in an envelope and it's brought with you through the reverse process. But, you know, just understand this. It's a generic statement saying that you're a risk if they let you in. If you're a risk, okay, based on a sex conviction, if they let you in, no one's going to let you in, okay, because someone has to stick their neck out. And so 99.9% of the time, if not 100% of the time, you're going back home. And that's how it works. And if you go back home because you're deported, yeah, you'll probably get a copy of it because you're going to get a packet. And some countries will include that as part of their packet. Some won't. But, you know, that's why some people get a hold of their statements and some don't.
Yes. Thank you, Chance.
You're welcome.
Mark, you've been waiting for a bit here. You've got your hand up. Okay.
Thank you. This is Mark. And I've got... Just on my same as I've kind of texted, just want to clarify for sure that. Hello? Somebody else has got.
I know. Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
After getting off California registration that involved a minor, that IML equally, as far as you know, still applies and can affect me. I'm somebody who's traveled the world since I was in my 20s and would love to continue to do so. So thank you.
You're welcome, Mark. Well, let me share my experience, and then I'd love to hear from you, Chance, what your experience has been or the experience of people contacting you. So when one of my clients gets off the registry in California, because through the petitioning process, I ask them, you know, if they're interested in international travel. And if they are, I send a notice to the Department of Homeland Security. I've got an email address. I can send that information. And I send the court order saying this person's no longer required to register. You know, please correct this in your records. Well, this is what the reply that I usually get back. This person is no longer required to give a 21-day notice under International Megan's Law. Well, that's good. This person's no longer required to have a unique identifier in their passport. Well, that's good. And then they say, and we, the federal government, reserve the right to send a notice to a foreign country that you're calling to travel there. So you might wonder, well, if I don't give the 21-day notice, how do they even know? And so it's my understanding, and I don't have any real firm proof of it, which I did one way or the other, is that the federal government is basically reviewing every flight manifest for every flight that originates in the United States. Listen to this language carefully. Every flight that starts in the U.S., our federal government is looking at the manifest, and they're and if they find out that you've ever been convicted of a sex offense, supposedly they are sending a notice to that country. I don't know if this is happening or not. I don't know if this is saber rattling on the part of the Department of Homeland Security or not. I hope it's not true, but perhaps it is. And then you think about it, if they're looking at every single flight manifest and you're talking about government employees, is it possible they might make a mistake? They might overlook you? Yeah, it's possible. I don't know, Mark. I don't know. I haven't heard of anybody who's gotten caught up in this at this point in time.
Janice, I want to confirm that when I was turned back at Singapore, I had already been there about 6 times. I never reported my travel to anybody. And so, yes, they just apparently randomly looked at the record and decided to turn me back that time. Okay, thank you. Yes.
Okay, I just want to add to this real quick, and this is what I said at the beginning, and I'll say it again so that you understand it. The reason they reserve the right is because the government's of the opinion that IML gives them a right to do this even if a person is – to send notices even if a person has been removed. And they made it very clear – during the IML litigation, which I was a part of, as well as Janice, that they look and they track people who go to countries where sex trafficking is going on. If you're going to countries where sex trafficking is going on, chances are if you've been removed from the sex registry and they still pick you up on their radar, they're going to send a notice. I mean, you know, that doesn't mean universally they're sending it for everybody. That would be way too extensive and way too difficult. It's hard enough for them to even notice people who are registrants on the registry because there is no federal registry. Let me repeat that. There is no federal registry. It's a patchwork of all the state registries. And when you go to it, some registries are up on the database and some are down. And so when they look at manifests, they can't always be correct as to whether a person is a registrant or is not because they can't always get that information. That is why they started demarking, putting demarcations on passports for those who are most of interest to them. Okay, so you can snitch off yourself when you get into the port if they miss you. It's a secondary way of ensuring that notice gets to your point of destination. Okay, but for those who have been removed, it would be way far too much work for the government to do. However, if they see a pattern of visitation to sex trafficking countries, they're going to make it their business to know who you are, and they're going to red flag you every time you travel. And I think they made that clear to us. And Janice, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's exactly what they said.
Well, I agree with you, Chancellor. I'm not going to correct you. And folks are like, okay, sex trafficking country. Every time I hear that term or anything similar to it, I think of something that a U.S. Supreme Court justice, who is still a U.S. Supreme Court justice, said, and it's Justice Alito. So there was a case Nichols, United States versus Nichols. There was a case in which that justice in a public hearing said the following, I'm paraphrasing, that the only reason that a man would go to the Philippines is to have sex with children. He said that in open court. I mean, it was one of those things that I almost fell out of my chair. And one of my board members said, sounds like he's talking from experience. Mm. Now, I don't know. It was a snarky statement. I was amused. But the fact is that that's not why every person goes to the Philippines. And when I filed my case, you know, challenging the international Megan's Law, one of my clients was married to a woman who was a citizen of the Philippines. And he was very desperate in trying to get back to the Philippines and to live together, their husband and wife, right? And he was being it was impossible for him to do so. So anyway, just know there's a bunch of nonsense out there. There's a bunch of people who stereotype, make huge stereotypes and sweeping statements, including Supreme Court justices, and that's what we're up against. So Phil Carberry, you've been very patient with your hand up. Would you please unmute yourself? And
yeah, this has been very, very informative, this travel thing. I mean, it's really clarified a lot. Thank you very much, Chance, and you also. My heritage, you're Italian, I'm Irish. I would like to go to Ireland. And it seems to me that that's not I was thinking that maybe I could go to the embassy here in San Francisco. Would that help? Or we're talking about these airports. They have the final say. So basically, no matter what, even if I had something from the embassy and I show my certificate of rehabilitation and I have removal of a felony for my third tier, I'd still have a hard time.
Yeah, Phil, I think that you would have a hard time still. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I want to basically make a generic statement here, which is just because you get a visa issued to visit a country does not necessarily mean you will be able to enter the country. And so that would be my concern for you, Phil, or anybody else. If you go to the embassy and you go, okay, I want to go, please give me a visa, and you convince them to give you a visa, it still doesn't mean that the immigration is going to allow you to enter the country.
Chance? Okay. Well, you know, my take on this is that's correct. And the way you do it, I think, is to contact an attorney in the country you're interested in and, you know, make sure they're knowledgeable on these issues and see whether or not they can assist you in making that trip happen, if at all possible.
There are some countries out there. I know Canada is one of them. In Canada, I feel a little bit better about Canadian law than some of these others. But in Canada, they basically don't want anybody who's been convicted of a felony to enter Canada, supposedly. And yet, if you go to a Canadian attorney, supposedly there's something that they can do, a formal process with the government that they can do to help you enter Canada. So I think Chance, you just gave some good advice. Contact an attorney in that country. And I happen to know a good immigration attorney here in the United States who might not be able to help you in another country, but I bet he knows attorneys in other countries. So Jeff, you've also been very patient with your hand. Do you have a question or a comment?
Two things. One is in terms of entering Canada specifically, I've had clients for whom the distinct difference between being excluded and being admitted was having an expungement of their conviction. DUIs, domestic violence, things like that. I've not had anyone on the registry who has been either resisted or admitted. But I agree, the Canadians are very persnickety about letting people in. The second thought was as to your Homeland Security notification process and the Schengen countries, I'm curious if you can relate any experiences those people who were terminated, who gave the notice, who then sought to get in, as to whether they were admitted or whether they were excluded from entry.
Let me just understand this for a minute. So what you're saying is once a person is removed from the registry, is that what you're saying?
I was thinking of Janice's illustration of those who were A, removed, and B, gave notice to Homeland Security of the removal by providing an order.
Well, okay, so Homeland Security is responding to Janice generically, okay, because Homeland Security is not going to make any kind of move whatsoever from any private attorney or source other than law enforcement. When they get notice or they verify that someone has been removed, they may or may not take action. But for us in the private, you know, as private attorneys, we can get an idea, a snapshot of how they're viewing it generically. But we can't really force them to move in any direction. If that's your question, we don't have the power to do that.
I was trying to get to the deductive component, which would be based on the experience, whether people who had been removed, gave notice, and then sought to enter those countries had been admitted at the time or had been obstructed. If you know.
Janice.
I'm sorry, I was reading the chat.
So the question is for those folks who want to go to the Schengen countries who have been terminated, have you had clients who have made that trip and were they admitted or were they excluded?
You know what? I assume they have, Jeff, because I keep telling them they can go there. And nobody has reported that they've had a problem.
They have not. Okay.
But, you know, the fact is, if you're currently required to register, you can get in, you can enter without a problem. So, I did have one client who tried to go to Amsterdam, and it was really sad because it was one of those situations where he consulted with me ahead of time, and he and his wife were going to Amsterdam, and then they were going to go to Italy, and they were meeting friends and all this other stuff. Well, this is the problem that he tripped over. So he and his wife were already on the airplane, you know, waiting for the takeoff. And he got a tap on the shoulder from somebody who said, "Oh, I'm from Homeland Security and your passport's been revoked." And that was the first notice he'd been given that his passport was revoked. And supposedly it was revoked because he didn't have a unique identifier in his passport. Now, I don't know if that person was telling me the truth or not, but he said that that was his first notice that he his passport had been revoked. So they took him off the plane.
And his wife followed him. Was this a post-terminated person?
No, he was still.
He was a registered.
Yeah. I mean, if you're asking for the post-termination world,
yes.
Okay, you're free to roam. Let me just say there's some caveats here. Okay, as you well know. And one of them is, you know, felonies count as far as access to countries go. And some misdemeanors count, domestic violence, DUIs, things like that. But for the most part, if you're removed from the registry, you're free to roam, you know, until and unless the government, you know, makes the decision that you're roaming into countries that they consider high traffic countries if they take notice of you. Okay, now that may never happen, but the general rule is you're free to roam. So if you're cleaned up and you don't have anything that's going to preclude you, like a still a serious felony conviction or so forth, you're pretty free to roam just like anyone else. You fall into the same category as your other clients in general, what their criminal background is and whether or not they have access to another country.
One other thought, maybe as a follow-up, it's always a source of a lot of anxiety to send the government any information because of the potential they're going to do bad things with it. Have any of the people, Janice, that you've sent in these notice of terminations on had any kind of negative reaction in response to those notices being sent?
No, but I will tell you that they're very cautious because of that whole statement about we reserve the right to notify the country to which you're traveling. I wish that organization had enough money. Well, maybe once I get Frank Lindsay off the registry, maybe we can afford to send him to Mexico or something to test the system. I just don't know. I don't know. And of course, Jeff, we don't, as attorneys, we don't hear from people if everything went right. Instead, we get to hear from them when something went wrong. I haven't heard from anybody that this had a problem since their removal and travel.
And it sounds like the lack of requirement for the 21-day notice applies equally to the people who send notice and the ones who do not, as long as they're terminated.
Right. Right. It's really clear. DHS is saying no need to send that 21-day notice, which is a huge relief for a lot of people, yep. Right? That in and of itself. And then the whole idea about unique identifiers. So if, in fact, my client had already gotten off the registry, which he can't because he's been assigned to Tier 3, and that's another issue we're going to talk about here fairly soon. But anyway, if he didn't have to have a unique identifier, he wouldn't have had his passport revoked. So, folks, we do have somebody with a hand up and who's already unmuted. So the phone number ending in 129, do you have a question or comment about travel? Alice, you have your hand up. Okay. Well, I'm just going to mute that person. We have Zoom user. Please unmute yourself. You have a question or comment here about travel.
Yes, hi.
Thank you, can you hear me?
We've got two people unmuted at the same time. I'm sorry. Zoom user, I'm going to mute you because 129 has been waiting for a while. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay.
Or ma'am. 129?
Janice, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm not 129, but I'm unmuted. So let me ask you real quickly, and it's very pertinent, and I've never heard you or Chance answer this question. So there's something called closed loop cruises, and according to a number of websites, if you start in one location on a cruise and you go back to the same location, so for instance, you leave from San Diego and you come back to San Diego, even if you were to go to Mexico, they do not require you to have a passport. They allow you to just use your California ID, the extended one, and they don't require a passport. Have you heard of that being the situation?
I have not. Have I any chance?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
So I think it's worthwhile. Please look this up because it's been written up in the newspaper a number of times. It's called closed loop cruises, and they do not, Royal Caribbean, Carnival, etc., do not require you.
I'm shocked. I hope you're right. Okay, thank you for that heads up. We'll look into it. Okay, Zoom user, it's your turn. I'm unmuting you, or asking you to unmute yourself, rather.
Okay, can you hear me?
Hello, Janet.
Yes, we can hear you, Zoom user.
Okay. First of all, I want to say thank you to you, Janice, and you, Chance, for everything you're doing, and also Jeff. My question has to do with state-to-state travel. I'm driving into Las Vegas and with my family and checking into a hotel. We're going to stay for 40 hours, and we're going to visit family outside of Nevada. For about 3 hours and then go back to another hotel in Las Vegas for another 40 hours. And I've been checking, and it seems like that shouldn't trigger anything. And I know Chance has commented in the past on stuff like that. And I just want to hear his insight.
Chance, why don't you answer that? I was reading a comment in the chat room.
I have my, unfortunately, my internet is in and out. So that was I heard a fracture of that. How long are you staying in Las Vegas?
I'm staying there for 40 hours and then leaving to visit for, say, 3 hours and then going back for another 40 hours.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way you've got to do it. But you're really, you know, yeah, you've got to break it up. I think probably you leave the state, cross the state lines, have a cup of coffee, use your, you know, your okay. credit, you know, and then
yes.
go, you know, and that, and I think that's the safest way to approach that without having to register. Don't stay, you know, 48 hours straight because you know
no.
that if you do that, you're going to be required to register and you don't want to register anywhere else other than California if you're a California resident.
Correct. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you. Okay, 129. We're going to try this one more time. I don't know if you, because we had one point, had two people talking at the same time.
Hi, Janice.
Hi.
You can hear me.
Yes, please.
I want to thank you and Chance for everything that you've done. I'm planning a cruise coming up in a couple months, and the cruise goes to Ensenada and Catalina. Now, I did this cruise like 10 years ago, and the only thing that happened was when we got off the boat in San Pedro, we had to go through a second screening. And so I'm not planning on getting off the boat in Mexico. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's good not to get off the boat in Mexico. I'm just a little... wondering about the comment that somebody made just a few minutes ago about, I can't even remember the term anymore, Jance, but closed looped cruise or something like that. I'd never heard of that before, so maybe it would be safe. But folks, there are cruise lines out there that won't allow anybody on the registry on board. So you have to be really careful about that. I had a client, it was many years ago now, it was on Royal Caribbean, and they, you know, he bought a ticket for himself and his wife, and they were going to go on this really long cruise and do all these excursions and stuff. And like a week before he was to leave, they sent him an email message. They put it in writing, we're not going to let you board the boat because you're a sex offender. So fortunately, they put it in writing, and they said, oh, and by the way, we're not going to give you any of your money back. So I wasn't able to get him on the cruise, but I was able to get his money back. In fact, they even paid for his flights and his excursions off the boat. But I just don't know. I don't have any specific information for you. And then Chance?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the risk is that they might not let you board, as Janice has said, and that is not because you're not going down Sonata. Because that's your choice. It's that they don't want to take the risk of you attempting to go down Sonata. So mm-hmm. I don't know that. That's why it's that Janice and I, you know, with this closed loop thing. This is interesting.
Need to do some of your own research. Is what we're telling you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate both of you.
And we appreciate you. Thanks so much. Okay, folks, we've been going at this for an hour and a half, and that's great. Interesting comments over there in the comments section. So you all might want to read it. So it says, a cruise to Nassau was blocked. It blocked the whole boat from entering the country because it was the gay cruise. I mean, if that's true, I've never heard of that before, but... you know, I know that there's some countries that do not respect the rights of people who are members of the LGBTQ community. So I guess I'm not totally surprised. But anyway, thank you for sharing that with us. Can we recommend an attorney in Mexico? No, but I can give you Paul Rigney's name and contact information. He has an attorney in Mexico that he relies upon. But I don't know who that is, who the attorney is. So I know, folks, that we've been trying to, you know, get some clarifications for a long time about Mexico, about some other countries, too, whether or not they're going to allow you. And by the way, Chance and I might as well share a story with you. This is not legal advice. I'm putting that in bold letters, verbally. We've heard some stories from people that have chosen not to fly into Mexico, but they get into Mexico some other way. And some of them walk across the border. Some of them take a taxi across the border, et cetera. So there might be ways to enter a country that does not require an airplane. And it seems that when people do that, they're treated differently. But that's not legal advice. Chance, you want any, have any stories to share?
No, but, you know, in general, you know, there's creative ways of attempt, you know, of accomplishing your goals. You just have to explore those possibilities.
Okay, so let's move on. We've covered a lot of ground in about an hour and a half, and that's remarkable and awesome. Do you want to give the Axel commercial before we talk about petitioning for removal?
Okay, I will. You know, everybody who's here today, I think, understands that this is an organization that is moving forward, and in the interest of all who have joined it, which are registrants, it can't operate, you know, by itself and alone. It needs your help. It needs your donations. It needs your volunteer work for service. So, you know, I'm just asking you to donate whatever you can, and donate as often as you can to help this cause, because this cause is your cause. It's our cause, and we can't do it without you.
Thank you. Okay, so let's move on to the tiered registry law here in California and the petitioning process. So Chance, Jeff, and I, all three of us, have filed multiple petitions for on behalf of individuals who are currently required to register, right? And we filed them in many different counties. So I'm happy to report I had my 66th person client get off the registry just in this past week. And I'm looking forward, and my goal is 100, and I have filed more than 100 petitions, so I may get there yet, but some of these petitions take longer than others. And I'll just say, this is an anecdote. This is not the law. This is an anecdote. There are two counties in California where my petitions have sailed through very quickly, and the two counties, one is in Southern California, Ventura County. Great surprise in Ventura County. They're not known to be kind to people in the registry, but they sure are processing petitions quickly. And the other one here in Northern California is Alameda County. And I don't know if it's because Nancy O'Malley, he used to be the DA there, and she was on the Sex Offender Management Board when they supported the tiered registry law. I have no idea. I was concerned in Alameda that after Nancy O'Malley left as the DA that things would slow down, but they haven't. So that's my experience, and I'd sure like to hear from Chance and Jeff about their experience. You know, from county to county, do you see any differences?
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jeff, my transmission broke up a little bit. I think she's asking you, is that it? And then I'm next or whatever.
Sure. I've had good experiences in San Luis Obispo County. I had good experiences in Ventura County, and uncertainty as to other places.
Okay, and I've broken that 100 case window a while ago. I have yet to be denied, and I think that's incredible luck, if nothing else. But there are counties that are a little bit more difficult than others. Orange County has been a difficult county. But since that decision, several of my cases have come around, and hearings seem to be dropping off the chart. So I'm really happy about that, because, you know, you never know. You're flipping a coin at a hearing. And if you look at the numbers, and Janice could give you a better idea about the numbers than I can. But the numbers say that there are denials, and I'm sure there are. Not a whole substantive bunch of them, but there are denials. For the most part, this remedy is running pretty well. And it's function. And as a county gets educated, they're actually doing better. I move all over the state. I'm everywhere. I'm just back right now from a case in Lake Worth. Probably most of you don't know where that is. It's about 2.5 hours above San Francisco in a mountain chain, in a coastal mountain chain. But, you know, every jurisdiction, including Lake Worth, you know, is pretty attuned to this, you know, to this remedy. And so it is getting better. It's not getting worse. If it were getting worse, I would tell you it's actually getting better.
I agree with you, Chance, with one exception. And I'm still having problems in Fresno County. And so there's a judge there. I'm just going to name him. His Capitan is his last name, K-A-P-E-T-A-N. And he's just sitting on a whole lot of petitions. I've talked to the public defender's office there and everything, and they're like, yep, that's what's happening. So there's some rumors out there that he's going to retire and these cases will be assigned to a new judge. I hope it's true. But that's the one county I've had the most difficulty in. The rest of the counties, you know, it's just been, I don't know. I think the longest it's taken is 6 months to get a petition all the way through the process. I'm happy to report, as I said, only 10% of the petitions I filed has the DA objected to. And then I've been able, and all of them except the one, to get the right decision from a judge. And I guess I really want to encourage people to go ahead and file their petitions or hire an attorney like Chance or Jeff or I to go ahead and file your petition for you. I know some people who are perfectly capable of filing their own petition intellectually won't do it because they have PTSD because of going through the court system. And I understand that. So if you don't want to do it, please don't do it. It can be cumbersome, this whole thing about who do you have to serve what, you know, and getting the conformed copy. I mean, we attorneys, we do it all the time, and it's not that much. It's not always simple, but at least we know what to do. And for somebody who's not in the system, it can be cumbersome, shall we say. So, for example, if somebody now lives in a different county than where they were convicted, that's when things start getting cumbersome, right? How many people do I have to notify, and et cetera? And I'll agree with Chance that things have gotten better, but I will say there's still a stick in the mud here. It's the Department of Justice. So we still have quite a few people, thousands of people who haven't gotten a tier assignment yet. And that's why we sued them. We sued them in January. And the lawsuit is proceeding ever so slowly through the court system. But I mean, at that point in time when we sued them, they had over 12,000 people that they had assigned to a tier. And I think it's just ridiculous. I mean, I think Chance, Jeff, and I, most of the time, if we look at somebody's record, a life scan report or something else, you know, like we can tell you within about 5 minutes' time what tier you should be assigned to, right? But they're not necessarily being assigned. And I was really frustrated in the beginning because I had a person who was convicted of a misdemeanor offense, a 647.6, which is annoying minor. And the law says this is a tier one offense, right? And yet the court rejected the petition. Because he didn't have a tier assignment. I had this similar experience with Frank Lindsay, my friend, you know, co-founder of the organization, et cetera, and, you know, been on the registry for so long. And the same thing is the DOJ had not assigned him to a tier. So the first time I filed his petition, it was rejected, not for any substantive reason, but because he didn't have a tier assignment, even though it was very clear he should have been assigned to tier two. I'm happy to report that on his birthday, or very close to it this year, he got a tier assignment. And so lo and behold, I refiled his petition. Hey, call-in user two, would you please mute yourself? I'm trying to mute you and you keep unmuting yourself. Please don't unmute yourself unless you get called on, because otherwise we can hear you coughing and other things in the background. Okay, so let's see. We do have, we've got several things going on here, folks, and I'm very aware that we've got 55% of the people who have gotten tier assignments have been assigned to the highest tier, tier three. And if you're assigned to tier three, as a general rule, you're not eligible to petition for removal. We know that. We are paying attention to that, and we're doing our best to solve the problem. And we're doing it through two different ways. One is through lobbying, which is the legislative branch, right, of things. The other way is through litigation. And so in Lobby Day last month, when we were here in Sacramento, we once again asked the legislature to provide everybody assigned to Tier 3 an off-ramp. And the off-ramp we requested was after 30 years, provided that you did not reoffend. Is that too long? Yes, it is too long. But we need to create the off-ramp first. And then I, honest to God, promise you, we will go back after the fact, after we get the off-ramp, and then we're going to go pursue reducing every single tier in duration. Right now, tier one is 10 years, tier two is 20 years. And I've been told by so many people, tier three, if you're going to have an off-ramp, it's going to be 30 years. Begin with, and then we'll go back and try to shorten periods of time. So, Jeff, you've got your hand up. Please, sir.
I wanted to add to the idea of tier designation letters being mistaken, this piece of information. Tier designation takes the conviction offense or what it has become by way of subsequent to conviction court action. So two common tier three offenses would be felony sexual battery or felony possession of child pornography. When those are reduced from felony to misdemeanor, as the law allows, the tier designation is supposed to go from tier three to tier one. So I had a recent experience at a client who I had gotten reduced on a sexual battery in January of 2021, who was coming up to his 10 years for a tier one offense. And he got his tier designation letter 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, and it showed him as tier three still. I took the certified copy of the order and emailed it to DOJ. And the next day I got a letter saying he could go reapply for a new tier designation letter. So I just wanted to raise the potential that the remedies exist to lower the tier, and it requires some vigilance and following up before you petition to make sure you don't mistakenly get booted out because of being improperly categorized by DOJ, which screws up things all the time.
All right. Yes, I concur. So I want to talk a little bit about some lawsuits that we have pending. Remember I said we're doing lobbying and trying to persuade the legislature to change the language in the tiered registry law. But we're also, we filed multiple lawsuits. I mentioned one of them, and that is suing the California Department of Justice for their failure to assign a tiers to everybody. But we also have a couple pending. One of them has to do with the attempts case. So anyway, people convicted of an attempted offense, right, versus being convicted of a completed offense. An attempted offense is a different penal code section. It's penal code section 664, right? It's not 288A or whatever. It's 664. And yet in many of these cases, California DOJ is assigning people to the third tier. They think that they have to do that. We think they should not do that. And so we have this case pending. In that case, we have filed the government and Axol. We have filed, cross motions for summary judgment. So we filed a motion for summary judgment. They filed a motion for summary judgment. We got the hearing on Monday. So I'll let you know after Monday, though the judge might take the matter under submission because it is complicated. You know, we're talking about the statutory language and how to interpret things that were said and things that were not said. But that's a big situation. And we've got two people, plaintiffs, two John Does in that case, both of whom were convicted of an attempted offense, not a completed offense, and yet ended up on tier three. And so for people who don't understand the difference, like between an attempted offense and stuff, again, it's a different penal code section, folks. You should not be like this. I think about rape. Okay. You're convicted of rape because you raped somebody. Okay. An attempted rape could be you basically unzip a zipper. Okay. You unzip a zipper. The other person says no, and you respect the no, and nothing else happens. That could be an attempted rape. I'm not saying it should be, but sometimes it is an attempted rape. But so why in the world would you be, you know, why should you be put in the same category as somebody who actually, you know, completed the act, shall we say? So anyway, we've got that case pending. It's an interesting situation in that the government did not file a motion to dismiss the case or demur, which is what they often do. And then they basically leave this decision up to an appellate judge, right? But in this particular case, I think the government doesn't know the answer either. And they're just, you know, we're all going to the court, the trial court judge here and saying, please give us an answer. I hope we get an answer sooner rather than later. But, you know, we'll see. And Homewrecker, I see that your hand is up. Let me go through a couple of other pending lawsuits and then I promise I'll call on you. One of them has to do with 288.2. So somebody convicted of penal code section 288.2 quite frankly, I don't even remember what that is. But we have some people who had a wobbler 280.2, and they had a reduced to a misdemeanor. And I know, Jeff, you were talking about wobblers a few minutes ago. In this situation, if you were convicted of a misdemeanor 280.2, the law doesn't even require you to register. Think about that. You're not even required to register. And yet California DOJ is assigning those people to tier three. So I'm talking about misdemeanor 288.2. We have a client, somebody who had a felony that was reduced to a misdemeanor, and he shouldn't be required to register at all. And instead, they've assigned him to tier three, which means he can't even petition for removal. So we think that's wrong, and we're challenging that. We did file another lawsuit, actually two lawsuits, trying to get two courts, one in Sacramento and one in Los Angeles, to get them to recognize that somebody convicted of 288.C, which is lewd or lascivious acts, was somebody who's 14 or 15. Right now, that is a tier three offense. It shouldn't be a tier three offense. We know it shouldn't be. There were a lot of political compromises made, folks, when the tiered registry law was finalized. And this is one of the mistakes that was made. So 280C, again, a 14 or 15 year old victim is on tier three, whereas people convicted of 288A, which a victim is under 14, is a tier two. And believe me, we do not want 288As to go up to tier three. We want the 288Cs to go down to tier two. So we did file two lawsuits. In both cases, the trial court judges were not willing to make a decision on the record, or thus really a substantive decision. So instead, they just granted the government's demur. We decided that it wasn't a good case to appeal either one of them. So that's one of the things that we're trying to change, really through the legislative process, through lobbying rather than through litigation. Okay, Homewrecker, you've got your hand up. Please unmute yourself, and then Mike is right behind you.
Hi. Do you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes, we can hear
okay,
you.
Okay. In Florida, they passed a bill where anyone who commits a crime involving a minor is eligible for the death penalty. You know, they can have the death penalty. And I was wondering if they pass a bill like that, what happens? If you pass a bill, does that become law automatically? And that, you know, right away they can just sentence you to death? How does the bill work into becoming a law?
Well, I don't know if you're confused or if I'm confused, but let me try this. So if the legislature passes a bill, it doesn't become law until the governor signs it into law, at least in California. So I don't know where Florida is in this process, but I know that many attorneys in Florida are very aware of this legislation and are going to fight it. Okay. And they will go in and request injunctive relief to prevent that from actually taking place, because folks, it's so wrong. I mean, I would think everybody on the call today on this.
Well,
Zoom
also DeSantis is fully backing it up. Just another reason to never go to Florida.
Well, you know, I don't want to get political here, but anyway, I will. I think he's a fool, and this is just further evidence of his foolishness. How's that?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, hi, Mike.
Chance, this may sound familiar. I think I asked you, or we talked about this when you were driving back from Lake County. There's a good chance I move to Europe this year. I'm eligible to petition for removal from the registry in 2025. I think it's been discussed on here if the timeline, you know, 2 year eligible to petition for relief from the registry, if that timeline gets paused if you move abroad. Chance told me, well, we don't know yet. I think, you know, it hasn't been litigated. Isn't there anyone like AG or somebody that we can ask that question to?
Oh, they would never give us an answer. They don't give advisory opinions.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it's a unique situation. You know, it really is. You know, and there are two interpretations of this. One is that, you know, if you go to a jurisdiction where you're no longer required to register, or you're not required to register, should that be held against you if you come back in at the time you're eligible and reestablish residency for this? I mean, it's an open question. I don't know the answer. And, maybe Janice has some insight into that.
No, I don't know the answer either. I will say that I had a client who didn't live in California the entire 20 years. Okay. But he was registered in another state part of that time. We weren't sure how this was going to work, but the fact is his petition was granted. Okay. So they didn't seem to have a problem with that. And I will say for folks who might have looked into certificates of rehabilitation in the past, a certificate of rehabilitation, the part of the eligibility is you had to live in the state of California for 5 years, at least 5 years before you submitted your application for a certificate. That's not the same thing with the petitioning process at all. But the petitioning process, I don't know what the minimum amount of time is, quite frankly. I had somebody who moved into a county from one county to another county, and 30 days later, he submitted a petition for removal, and it was granted. And so that didn't cause a problem either. So it's not just even in the state, but in the county. I don't know, Jeff, do you have any ideas about that?
I do. I think there is no residency requirement. I actually litigated to the Court of Appeal, challenged to the Certificate of Rehabilitation, 5-year residency, and lost. But I had a client who was a resident of another state. The strategy was to try and terminate his California duty. He moved back. The week after he moved back, he registered. We filed a petition a few days later, and he's now terminated.
Fabulous.
Well, that makes perfect sense, because you've got to come back in the state in order to and have residency in order to do that.
Exactly.
But you know, the question here is, if you move elsewhere and you're not registering, when you come back into the state and you reestablish residency and you're checking the box saying that, you know, I'm let's just say you're a first tier guy, so you're going to say I'm tier one, and then there's another box, I've registered for at least 10 years. You can't check that box. Because you haven't. If let's just say you've registered for 5 years in California and you went to Europe and then you came back when you're eligible and reestablished residency, you registered for 5 years prior to. So what is that area there, the time you didn't register, is, you know, can it still be granted or not because you didn't check that full 10-year box? Does it require a full 10 years of registry and tier one status in order to be removed? That's the question.
Yeah, the way
and there's no answer.
The way we managed it was we relied on his being subject to the registry for 10 years, and the DA didn't object, so the court terminated him.
Okay.
So when something like that happens, folks, that's not precedent, right? That is a one-time good deal, but it's not precedent. So we have to be careful, and knowing that in one county on one day, somebody's petition was granted, but it may not happen in a different county on a different day. So yeah. Okay. Do we answer your questions, Mike?
Yes, thanks. And I wasn't disputing anything. Chance told me it was simply I didn't ask him the question, is there anyone we can ask, like the Attorney General or someone? So you definitely answered that.
Yeah, they won't give it. Sure, they won't give advisory opinions, and I don't blame them.
Right.
So it's one of those things. If you really want to know, you know, you have to file a lawsuit. Okay. So we didn't talk about domestic travel, and it is the summertime. I think we should talk about it at least briefly, and talk about it for people in two categories: people who are currently required to register, and those who are not currently required to register. And what is my answer? It's going to be the most generic attorney answer. The answer is it depends, right? So when a court grants a petition that removes somebody from the California registry, that only affects California, right? And so, okay, you don't have to register in California. Might you have to register other places? I think the answer is yes, you might have to register in another place, either as a visitor or if you go move there permanently. Please do not make the mistake of thinking that just because you're no longer required to register in California, that you do not have to comply with other states' laws, registration laws. Okay. So if you're going to move to another state, this is my general advice, not giving anybody specific legal advice. The general advice is talk to an attorney in that state before you move there. Okay. You need to figure this out before you go there, because if you move there and you don't register, but you should have registered, guess what? You're going to be in a heap of trouble. And it's called failure to register, right? In many states, you could be convicted of a felony for failure to register. So it's really, really important for you to figure that out before you move to another state. It's also important if you can figure this out before you go visit another state. So what do I usually tell my clients or anybody else who asks me the question is, folks, if you're going to go visit another state, you have two approaches. One of them is the inexpensive approach, and one is the expensive approach. The inexpensive approach, as I describe it, is you just act as if you are still in the registry, that you would be required to register there, and then you act accordingly. So when we were talking earlier about going to the state of Nevada, they have a 48-hour requirement, and so does Florida, by the way. Just the inexpensive way to do this is you just like, well, if I were on the registry, if this law did apply to me, then I could only stay 47 hours maximum before I have to register there, okay? The expensive way to do it is before you go visit another state, you contact an attorney in that state, and they can figure it out for you. There's 50 states out there, folks, and there's 50 different registration laws. And so it's really, there are opportunities, shall I say, to basically hit one of these tripwires and end up at least charged with, if not convicted of failure to register. So Chance and Jeff, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
I give exactly the same advice. Check one of those two ways. There's a Googleable listing of state laws, not necessarily current, but close, around the country, interstate travel, and it's a good starting point. But the follow-up is exactly as you described.
And Chance?
Well, we have, you know, on the ACSOL website, we do have some information regarding, you know, states, and you can start there as a jumping point, but, you know, the law's dynamic. You can find out, you know, where you need to look for it in any particular state if we have it listed. But you really got to go to that state and look up the laws first to just become familiar with the body of it. And then, of course, I agree. I think, you know, you need to go further and you need to consult with a lawyer who's familiar with those laws and can help you. You know, plan things out so that you don't get yourself caught up with legal liability. So I think that's what Janice says. Very, very good advice.
Thank you. Gentlemen, okay, we've got Jeff who has his hand up, followed by Zoom user. Jeff, you're unmuted. Please go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Just a quick question about domestic travel. I was thinking about becoming a truck driver and, you know, traveling to the states, obviously. I don't know. Are there any states that require you to like register, you know, if I like instantly, I guess, like if you're going to be staying at a truck stop overnight or what is your opinion on doing a job like that and actually driving across, you know, from the West Coast to the East Coast? Would that be a good idea? Or?
Well, I actually know several people who are on the registry and who drive a truck for a living. And so just what you said, if you're just driving through a state, you don't have to notify anybody that you're driving through. If you spend the night, one night, I don't know of any place that requires you to register for spending one night. And so I think, you know, you still be safe there. But you know, the question is, well, what happens if your truck breaks down, right, in a state and stuff? And oh, my gosh, I don't know if you can get around that or not. In other words, can somebody come and take you out of that place and so another truck driver can come in? But I think in general, truck driving is and I guess truck drivers are really in demand right now. And so I think it's a great career, can I say that, for people on the registry. But Chance and Jeff, what do you think of that?
It gets complicated. And that is that SORNA kind of, this new SORNA rule kind of complicates things because you're entering into interstate commerce. And, you know, that is the, you know, the first thing that happens that triggers the statute. I wish I could be advisory as to what the statute actually requires, but I can't, and not at this point. And so that's one layer that really complicates things. You know, as far as staying in one place or another, during and through the scope of your employment, you know, you can check out states, on any itinerary, as you move through, and you can be aware of what's required and what's not. But in general, if you're moving and you're only being, you know, you're only in one place for a moment temporarily, I see no issue with that. The only complication I see is what's required by this new rule. And it just hasn't been figured out yet.
I agree. Jeff?
Yeah, I'd say check the individual state laws that you're going to be on your path driving through and be mindful of what their durational limits are. Otherwise, you should be fine.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Zoom user, you've got your hand up. I'm asking you to unmute yourself.
Yes, first of all, I want to make a comment about what the question is just answered. I know that Illinois goes, I think, 3 days as far as through 365 days a year. So I think he would be okay if he was in a truck stop, but if he stayed at a hotel, I think that would trigger one of his days, you know what I mean? And he would only be allowed to stay three. And I think he'd have to really check Tennessee because from people that I follow and that on the blogs that here, Tennessee is really strict too as far as only 2 days or 3 days per year. But anyways, my question is, as far as, you know, not being on the registry and traveling and being subject to all these other registries in all the other states, is there any litigation that, you know, will eventually get to Supreme Court to make this punitive and not, you know, civil, that would just subject everybody just to be punished, I guess?
I don't think it would be retroactive if the law were to change. I always have Smith versus Doe out there to worry about. So I don't think that's a big concern. It's not a big concern that I have.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Thank you. There is a question in the chat room that I'm going to raise, which is, it says, I live in California. When traveling in California, when do I need to register in another county in California? Well, if you're just traveling through, you don't have to register. But the whole idea or the question, I think the bigger question is, when do you establish a residence, right? So if you establish a residence in a different county, then you may have to register there. And like, okay, then tell me what the definition of residence is. And I'm going to tell you, I don't know, because the case law out there is really uncertain and quite frankly, all over the place. So, you know, I always think of this one gentleman who unfortunately was charged with and convicted of failing to register because he worked in a person's home. He was a home health care provider and he was there like 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. He didn't live there. He didn't get his mail there. He didn't sleep there. You know, I don't think he took showers or anything else. And yet they said, because he was there on a regular basis that he resided there. And unfortunately, that went up to an appellate court, and the appellate court agreed that he had failed to register. I think that's a wrong decision, but it's on the books, right? And so there's something called concurrent registration that I hope everybody is aware of, which is if indeed you have more than one residence in the state, then you need to concurrently register at all those residences. We have a board member who has 4 homes in the state of California. He is registered at all 4 homes. So if you were to look at his profile on the Megan Salt website, you would see 4 different addresses. I question whether or not he really has to be registered at all 4 of those addresses. But he said, look, I want to be very conservative in my approach here. And if I decide I want to spend the night at one of my homes, then darn it, I want to be able to do that without worrying about getting charged with, much less convicted of a failure to register. So again, the question about whether or not you have to register in a different county all depends upon whether or not you've established a residence there. Jeff or Chance, you want to add something?
Yeah, I think the penal code uses the phrase regularly reside to describe the issue. So if a person temporarily visits on a ongoing basis at someone else's home, I think they're at risk of being characterized, if discovered, as regularly residing. And at some point that becomes a duty to register for that location. As Jenna said, it's a very vague part of the law, and it's difficult for law enforcement to develop proof over, but it is certainly provable. And so, you know, you have to be careful as to where you regularly reside. If it's random reside, so if you travel from Fresno to Merced to Visalia and then to Paso Robles, you're probably exempt in all those places except the home. But if you go from Paso Robles, where your home is, to Visalia to a vacation home, even if it's not your vacation home, but someone else's, but you regularly reside there, I think you probably have the duty to register.
And then even, yeah, more specifically than that, if you travel outside your county and you're going to stay in a hotel or a motel or somewhere for 5 business days, you're going to be required to register. Okay. That's just a fact. Okay. So, you know, if you're traveling, you're staying here for one day or there for one day, no. And if you're visiting someone, even if you exceed the 5 days, if it's just once, maybe not. But, you know, I think, and this is just my thinking, you're going to be anywhere solid for 5 business days. You're probably going to be required to register. Okay. And that, and, you know, outside your own county. And so that's the general rule of thumb, I think.
And I will say that under SORNA, this is one of those gotchas, and under SORNA, it basically says if you're away from your home residence from 7 days or longer, I believe, that you're going to have to notify. You know, not necessarily register there, but you're going to have to notify somebody. Or maybe it does say you have to register there. This is one of the things that really bothers me. One of the many things that bothers me about the SORNA regulations, because right now, if you're, you know, away from your home, let's just say you decide you want to go camp all around the state of California, don't stay any place more than 5 days, you don't have to tell anybody. But they're saying under the SORNA regulations that you do have to notify law enforcement. And by the way, we do have a comment here that says my local sheriff's office asked me to email them when I travel in my home state of California, if I stay overnight in a hotel. Well, if you were my client, this is what I tell you. You have no duty to notify them. Why would you notify them? I mean, that's ridiculous. On the other hand, if you want to get along with the sheriff's department, I guess you might want to do it, even though you're not required to do it. Chance?
Yeah, I go with your first response. It's none of their damn business, because it has nothing to do with what the law requires. And often law enforcement gets into your stuff when they really don't belong there. So, you know, absolutely imperative, you know, the law and what it requires. And if you don't, consult with an attorney so that you can tell them to pound sand when they ask you to do something that's not required.
Oh, good. Somebody else swore first today. Thank you, James. All right. Still, you got your hand up here. Phil, did you unmute yourself?
Yeah, this is, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, this is all a new thing to me. Okay, I was in Hawaii in the fall for a week. I was in Kentucky in the fall at my sister's house. I flew there. Where else was I? I was in Southern California for a week in San Diego, Palm Springs. And how, okay, so I didn't, when did this, is this a new thing, the SORNA thing, or what? I mean, what, I'd never heard of this before, and how would they know if you're renting a car, if you're driving, you know, how do they know?
You know this is being recorded, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
That's one way.
Oh, is it, way, this is being recorded? By, no.
Another way is through credit card records and stuff, so... You know, I mean, these days, the government seems to know so much about us. I know locally in my local jurisdiction, you know, they've got cameras at almost every stoplight, for God's sakes, wanting to know, you know, driving up and down the street. What? Okay. What, you know. So anyway, there's obvious information out there, and people, you know, can, in fact, track you down and such. So again, you know, the information that Chance and Jeff and I are sharing today, we're just trying to help you avoid difficulties, challenges, the possibility of going to jail or prison. And so a lot of times there are not absolutes. I don't know about you, Chance, but when I went to law school, before I went to law school, I thought, I'm going to law, go to law school. They're going to teach me all the laws and, you know, everything's going to be in black and white. Once you start reading the cases, you find out that's not it at all, because always these laws and the language of the laws, including the tiered registry law, are subject to interpretation. So again, you know, and many times I tell my clients, it's like, here are the risks. There's a spectrum of risk. You have to decide where on the spectrum you want to be. And some people want to be on the absolute most conservative part of the spectrum. Other people are willing to take risks. So it's really many times up to the individual. Okay, I think that's, David?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Phil. Let's go and move on to David Bleeker. David, your hand is up.
Yeah, I appreciate the insights and the wisdom that you guys are providing. I had a question. One of the guys in our treatment group has had contact with people from Sonar who have informed him that he would need to be at his residence, at least, you know, he couldn't be away from his residence for more than 10 days. That on 10 days or less, he has to be, you know, there where they can check on him. Is that just a parole kind of issue, or is that something? Because, for example, I would like to do, when I get off parole, I would like to be doing landscape photography, which would take me out of my residence potentially for a month or two. You know, going, because I would be hiking, I'd be, you know, going to different locations to be able to take photographs. So being, you know, having to come back for every 10 days in that scenario would increase the expense, obviously, but it's also somewhat onerous to think that you'd have to report back, even though you're maintaining your residence. You know, I wouldn't be staying in a place long enough to trigger any kind of residency. It would be take pictures, move on to the next location.
And David, are you talking about locations? Are you talking about locations outside the state of California?
Well, he was saying that they came to his house periodically to validate that he is there. They said to him, he can't be away from his house for longer than 10 days. So I don't know that there's a destination in mind. I think they just need to verify that, no, you're still at the residence that you said you were at.
And did you say this person's on parole?
Yes.
Well, then that's a parole condition. So, yes, he has to comply with that. But if you're not on parole,
is that,
he won't.
So that would be just for parole. So they wouldn't be an issue for me if I went up and down California or into other states and was away from my residence for an extended period of time?
If you're not on parole, you're not on probation, I don't think there's any requirement. There's a small risk here because of SORNA. And as I said earlier, SORNA says if you leave for more than your residence for more than 7 days, you have to do so. But right now, SORNA does not apply to people in California.
Right. Right.
Okay. I think that's the clearest answer I can give you right now.
Very good. And I did have a question earlier on in terms of the search and seizure. If we can cycle back to that at some point, it'd be fantastic.
Well, why don't you ask now? The meeting, we're winding down the meeting. I would imagine we got another 10 minutes, and that's about it.
Yeah, so mine was the first question. It was about the contact relationship letter that my parole agent requires that I, you know, have everybody that is a potential friend or, you know, romantic interest that they would need to sign. And one of the things that it talks about is that I understand the search and seizure policy. I don't know that I can articulate that to you know, potential friends, enough to be able to, you know, assuage any concerns that they may have, that they may be somehow put into jeopardy because, you know, I happen to be there and, you know, I'm searchable.
Right. So you're on parole right now, David?
I am. Right?
Yeah. Well, when you're on parole, you have a lesser expectation of privacy. And therefore, I mean, it's a parole condition. They can search you anytime that they want. I mean, maybe right. if you're talking about friends or whatever, you might show them your parole condition that says that, you know, they can search you at any time and in any place. So I guess maybe like you're talking about if you went to a friend's house for dinner or something like that, could they come there and search you? Yes. Whether they can not, they could search anybody else. Probably not. But I'm getting into dangerous territory here. I need a real criminal defense attorney to back me up.
Well, you are searchable 24/7, and
correct.
Wherever you go, so is that area. You know, just because you're in that area doesn't mean that everybody else is immune from it. That's the point. The point is that if you're in someone's house, that opens up the house to parole. They don't have to say you can't come in because they can say you can't come in. If you're in that house, they can come in. Wherever you go, they can go. So, and you know, that's the diminished right you have now while you're on parole. You don't have your search and seizure rights. So, you know, they can do that and you have to understand that. And if other people have stuff hanging out that can cause them legal liability, you know, that can happen in plain sight or in plain smell or in plain whatever, wherever you are. So people need to know about this thing. And they need to know
right.
so that they can say yay or nay as to whether or not they want to take that risk.
Sure. Yeah. I kind of, you know, understood, you know, certainly my part in that. But I didn't know, you know, what that would look like from, so if I went over to somebody's house with a, you know, they, you know, the, is it parole? It's actually in California, it's parole or any peace officer, right? Any police officer can search at that point.
I'm not understanding what you're asking, but if you're on parole or probation and you've got, you know, search conditions, you know, that's, you know, wherever you go is, you know, open territory for, you know, search and or seizure and anything else that can be found in plain sight, plain smell or whatever else. And so
yeah.
that's just the rule of thumb. That's just it.
So
very
David, we're going to have to move on. If you have any more specific questions, why don't you contact Chance or Jeff us
absolutely.
Privately? Because also remember, this is being recorded.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. Zoom user, you got your hand up, and we got Jeff after that. And folks, after these two calls, we're going to wrap things up. So Zoom user, you have a call, a question rather.
Actually, I was just going to do a comment again, because I was saying I was going on my vacation. And I do trigger the Sonora, you know, notify how long I'm going to be gone. I was a little bit stressed, but what I did is I wrote down my address, the date I'm leaving, the date I'm arriving back, which is 10 days, and just the states, because I don't have any, we're staying at hotels or, you know what I mean? I don't have any yet. Mm-hmm. So they were really good about it. I'm in Michigan. They were really good. He just wrote a note on my file and he said, you're good to go. So I didn't know, you know, if that helps anybody else.
And are you on parole or probation?
No.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I don't think it's required, but if you want to get along with your registration officer, maybe that's a good thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, in Michigan, if you're gone from your residency more than 7 days, you have to comply with the Sonora or SORNA.
So,
okay. Yeah.
I thought you were in California. I apologize. So,
oh, no. Sorry, Michigan.
If that's what Michigan requires, please do it. Okay. I'm going to move on to Jeff now. Jeff, you've got your hand up.
Quick question, and then I'd see if you can give me a shout out to somebody here. Question is any status update on maybe having in person meetings? And also, could you do a shout out to the person that does your website? Because they do an excellent job putting the articles on there. It's just very, very good. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we have two people working on our website. Chuck is the person who knows kind of big picture stuff. And then Roger is the person who posts the articles. So thank you for that positive feedback. Yeah. Okay, folks, this is the time. I don't know about Chance and Jeff, but I'm pretty exhausted and hungry and want to eat some lunch. we really, truly appreciate the fact so many people joined us today. I think we got up to 65 or so. Our next meeting is on May 20th. We please want you to continue consulting the website as well, because, of course, there's breaking news all the time. And again, thank you, thank you, and thank you. Chance.
All right. Yes, thank you. And also an announcement. I'm changing my domain name, and it's going to be OversteinLaw.com in the future, in the near future. So I know that Janice and I both invite you to look us up, Google us, find us. In the near future, that's what it's going to be, OversteinLaw.com. So you won't see Chance there, but you'll certainly see my last name hanging out there somewhere in the virtual ozone. But thank you for joining us. I appreciate it so. And it is just a wonderful time to be together and talk about these issues. Thank you.
Jeff, our newest board member, you get the last word.
The last word? The last word would be gratitude. I think it's a great community sharing, and I'm grateful for being able to both contribute and learn. So I'm involved because this is a passion for me. I'm in San Luis Obispo. I've been doing this work since 1970s, and I hope to do it for a good while longer.
And thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Chance. Take care, everybody. Hope to see you on May 20th. Bye-bye.